Calendar today, appeal number 06-40-33, United States v. Timothy Hearns. Mr. McGowan, nice to see you. We'll see you twice, I believe, today.
Pleasure is mutual, and it will be twice. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Andrew McGowan. I'm with the Federal Public Defender's Office for the Central District of Illinois, and I represent the appellant in this case, Mr. Timothy Hearns. Mr. Hearns raises two well-worn issues in this court. The first is whether failure to return to a halfway house under Wisconsin law should be considered a crime of violence. The second is whether the district court should have been able to consider the 101 disparity between crack and powder guidelines. Unless there are any questions about the crack and powder disparity argument, I don't intend to pursue that orally today, although we do rest on the brief. Mr. Hearns raised the failure to return to a halfway house not being a crime of violence argument in the district court. However, he relied simply on the facts of his case, which indicate that he failed to return after he was given permission to leave to do laundry.
Are you involved in any of those other cases that Burke and Parker appeals?
Your Honor, we're not directly involved with those cases. However, we are aware of them. Burks and Parker, and Burks, as I understand it, will be briefed. The most recent brief is due in a few days, I believe.
Yeah, I just want to know if you were counsel in either of those.
Your Honor, I can tell you a little bit about those cases because in Parker, for instance, the issue was not raised in the district court. I believe he was sentenced before the court's opinion in chambers.
Burks it was.
Yes. I believe this court will see many cases in the near future with the actual statistics from this report that was done by Court Data Technologies.
The statistics are provided to us. I just can't make a lot of sense out of them personally.
Your Honor,
maybe I'm slow, but it's hard to believe there's 6,700 escape cases in Wisconsin.
Well, if the point in chambers was that many of them, most of those, 90% are failures to return or appear, that even puzzles, clouds the water even more. I agree with this court. With Your Honor's comments, I've looked at these statistics, and I wish they were broader. I wish they included more states. I wish that they were not just statistics, because they don't include actual violence. And in fact, what the person was trying to do was compare these failure to returns and escapes with multiple counts, including resisting arrest, which can include giving false names. I mean, they don't necessarily include any violence. On the other hand, this is the beginning of the data that this court will see on this, I hope in the future. Although the Sentencing Commission doesn't appear to have taken up this court's suggestion that it do some statistical analysis nationwide. But that being said, Your Honor, with the fact that this issue may change somewhat with this court's reviewing of these statistics, I would note that it looks like at most 15% of these cases have resisting charges as well. That's in the escape cases, and in the failure to return, they're a little less. We would simply request that make another motion, in fact, since this court has denied the first motion, if this court would hold ruling in this case until those cases have been decided. We filed that pre-oral argument. Alternatively, since we're not involved in these other cases, we would gladly supplement the record with our analysis of these statistics. The supplemental.
I don't know that that's necessary. This is the horse that's been beaten many times.
In any event, those are the comments that I prepared. Unless there are any questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you. Mr. Anderson.
Good morning. My name is Robert Anderson. I'm an assistant U.S. United States attorney in the Western District. I did represent the United States at the trial court level on this matter. I will endeavor not to, Judge Evans said, beat a dead horse, but both of these issues here are issues raised which ask this court to depart from settled precedent on the issue of whether an escape constitutes a crime of, is counted as a crime of violence, and whether the sentencing under the guideline crack cocaine ratio is reasonable. Of course, to overturn precedent of this court, there has to be a compelling reason to do so, and in this instance, there is no compelling reason to do so in this case, and there is no record upon which the court could do so. The precedent of this court in Bryant, Howes, Franklin, Chambers, and Golden still stand as they are, as well as the support of 10 other circuits that have decided the same way, the only outstanding circuit being the Ninth Circuit, which is not unusual to have a different approach. All finding categorically, and using the categorical approach that the Supreme Court recognized in Taylor, that an escape is a crime, should be considered a crime of violence. Bryant is almost identical to this case. A walkaway is defined as an escape, and thereby defined as a crime of violence, because the under the definition in 4B1.2a, it does inherently present a serious potential risk of physical injury to another person. Someone who escapes, to make the distinction between what escape situations are from what the appellant argues in his brief, that this could apply more broadly to other crimes, the difference is someone who escapes is under a sentence. They know they're to be incarcerated. They know that they are going back to incarceration if they are captured. They know they are likely going back to a greater security of incarceration, and they know that likely they will be given added punishment, whether administratively or by additional charges.
But under Wisconsin law, an escape is completed at the moment of the departure from the institution in the case of a walkaway.
Right.
Or the non-return by the appointed time in the case of a felony escape that consists of not returning from a halfway house or a work release facility. So what right. may happen down the road upon apprehension really doesn't matter for purposes of the escape conviction.
Well,
and what it takes under the law to be convicted of escape.
But I think one of the arguments that appellants, not just here, but in other cases, seem to make is that if you're escaping from a less secure facility, you're not using violence in the escape itself. That ignores that the real difference is that it's on the recapture of the individual that they know they don't have to have used violence to have walked away or initiate the escape in the beginning, but it presents a risk to police officers or other citizens in apprehending that person after they have escaped. Even if they peacefully walked away from a detention facility, the person has an incentive, a potential incentive, to want to avoid recapturing, going back to that certainty, unlike when an individual is merely committed an offense or there's a warrant out for them and they don't know what the outcome is going to be. They can go to trial, they'll get out on bond, any other number of possibilities. This is a certainty for the individual, which presents that greater risk. And this court correctly held in Franklin, Davis, Bryant, and Howes that the real benchmark is whether there's a possibility, not the probability, but the possibility that there could be a violent confrontation. And when you have someone who wants to avoid going back to certain incarceration, that possibility, real possibility, does exist there. So Hearn's escape conviction does qualify as a violent felony, regardless of how nonviolent the actual escape was. His status as an escapee carried inherently that potential risk, and he presents no compelling reason for this court to overturn its precedent. I'll just make a brief note, since he didn't argue very much, the guideline crack cocaine ratio, but I would note that there really is, it's unnecessary for this court to hold the decision, this decision in abeyance pending Kimbrough, because whatever is decided in Kimbrough is not going to impact Mr. Hearns. Kimbrough will only address whether the district court may consider the disparity between crack cocaine and the powder cocaine, the ratio between them. It will not require that a district court must consider that ratio or must consider the disparity. and that question isn't even presented in the Kimbrough case. And there's nothing in this record from Judge Shabazz's sentencing to indicate that he had any hesitation or second thoughts about the ratio, imposing the ratio. And in fact, in the sentencing transcript, Judge Shabazz says, you are deserving of the maximum sentence. He ultimately didn't give him the maximum sentence, but he indicated that he believed he deserved the maximum sentence. He didn't have any hesitation or reluctance to use the crack cocaine ratio. And again, moreover, the defendant didn't object, so obviously there would need to be a plain error here, which makes it an impossibility to get to a plain error in this case. There can't be a plain error when this court has held in the past that it would be reversible error for the court to have ignored the guideline ratio and substituted a different ratio in its place, that in the Jointer case, I believe. So the district court couldn't have done that. So based upon the record and the existing law, which there's no reason to depart from, I'd ask that this court affirm the district court's order and judgment.
Mr. Pagan, anything more?
Unless there are any questions.
Okay. Thank you. We'll take the case under advisement and proceed.